Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, we all pay lots of insurance, but are we paying for the right things and are we paying the right amount? Could the Savings and Investment Union be our answer to a lack of infrastructure investment at the same time as low returns on our deposits? And this...
When we all close our eyes and
later in the show, we'll be talking about the economics of global food chains and why they are coming under pressure. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on LinkedIn, Instagram, X and Blue Sky at Susan Hayes-Cullerton. And I absolutely love to hear from you. So please do come forward and tell us what you think of what we're talking about each week. Now, I'm going to start off by explaining to you what a tax head is. A tax head is a category of tax collected by a government, so like income tax or corporation tax or VAT, which is value-added tax. But why am I telling you this? Well, there's a lot of talk these days about Ireland's corporation tax, and you also might hear the term a tax head around the Exchequer returns, and I'll also be talking about it from time to time on the show as well. So now you know, when people refer to a tax head, it's simply just a category of tax. Now before we start, I want to give a special shout out to the 5,087 students who had the Leaving Cert Economics exam on Friday, and you never know, I could be interviewing some of you in the years to come. Now we all pay for insurance, but are we insuring the right things or just throwing money at policies out of habit or fear? So from overpriced gadget cover to overlooked income protection, many of us may be getting it backwards. And so today we're asking, are we insuring what really matters? We're joined now by my colleague, Sinead Ryan, presenter of The Home Show here at News Talk. Hello, Sinead.
Hello, Susan. How are you?
I am great altogether. And I'm really looking forward to talking to you about this because it's a really important topic and everybody who's listening is likely to be affected by our conversation today. So, Sinead, I looked at Insurance Ireland's most recent fact file, which is dated for 2023. It was the most recent one I could find. Premiums per capita or per person were €4,137 in 2023. And the year before, the amount was €3,810. So, Sinead, we're spending a lot on insurance, but are we insuring the right things?
It's a huge household outgoing. There's no doubt about it, Susan. And you know better than anyone that insurance of all kinds, it's considered a negative purchase. You never want to have to avail of what you're buying. And you do it in a lot of cases because the alternative is worse. So there's no, you know, people don't get a joy out of, you know, filling out an application form and buying an insurance policy. They'd far prefer to be spending their money on other things. However, it is a necessary evil and in some cases mandatory. So when you're talking about car insurance, you must have that. And if you've got a mortgage, you must have house insurance. Now, beyond that, you have choices, of course, and lots of families do make choices based on their income and what they can afford and the type of products they can buy. But premiums across the board, there's only one insurance product where the premiums are falling, and that's life insurance. And that's because we're living longer, healthier lives and underwriters price that in. For everything else, the cost is going up. So it is a big chunk of change. And, you know, a lot of people resent having to pay for insurance policies across the board. But yet, if you say to them, look, you can ditch your health insurance, you don't need it. You can ditch the car if you want to get rid of the cover. Of course, people balk at that because the alternative concerns them.
And you know, it's the one thing, it's the one expansion aid where we actually don't want to use it. Like, I don't want to use my car insurance over and above paying the premium. I don't want to because obviously then if I do, something has gone wrong along the way. So what are the common mistakes people are making then? Are they underinsuring? Are they overinsuring or duplicating what they're spending? Or is it that they're looking at this the wrong way around altogether?
It's all of those things. And Susan, that feeds into the fact that people largely, because they're so cross at having to pay it at all, that they tend not to examine the purchase. So when your renewal notice arrives in, and by law, insurance companies must provide you with a period of notice, usually up to a month before your policy renewal, whether it's house insurance, health insurance, car insurance, for you to sit down, do comparisons, make a choice, ring around, shop around. But loads and loads of times, of course, people don't do that. They wait till the last minute. They wait till they get the final reminder in and they just say, ah, here, and renew it blindly. So the first thing people can do is to assess, do I need this? And, you know, it might be the case that you have that product or that service elsewhere. So a classic example would be travel insurance. Now, anybody who has a credit card, particularly one of the better ones or the more expensive ones, may well have travel insurance included in that. And you don't need it twice. Insurance company will only pay out once. You can't get more under insurance law. You can't receive more than the cost of the incident that happens. You can't profit from insurance. So it might be that you already have it. People who have private health insurance, some of the better plans out there, also have travel insurance attached to it. So it's worth examining if you actually need it. The other area, I've mentioned life insurance. Now, we tend to hold on to life insurance because we're desperately worried about not leaving things when we're behind us, when we're gone. We want to leave, you know, our funeral paid for, our house paid off, money to our kids and all that. That's fine to a point. If your kids are reared and your mortgage is paid off, get rid of the life insurance. What are you holding on to it for? Who is it for and what is it for?
But isn't it very low? If you get your life insurance early enough, which I did because I was younger when we were getting the mortgage, doesn't it make sense then, Sinead, just to hold on to it for... If you've been paying for it all your life, and basically since if the premium was low all along, is it not you're by not paying it, then you're letting the benefit go anyway?
Yeah, well, it depends what type of cover you have. So if you have what's called term insurance, which is generally set up along to run alongside a mortgage. Now, that's not for you, by the way, or your dependents. That's to make sure the bank gets paid in case you die mid-mortgage. So if you have term insurance to go alongside your mortgage, the amount of that is decreasing over the term of the mortgage alongside the mortgage. And when it's all paid off, it's all finishes together. But there is a type of insurance called whole of life insurance. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very popular. It was very popular in the 90s and the early noughties, where insurance companies said, you know what, don't waste your money, invest it. We'll give you life insurance, but put extra in. It'll last the whole of your life, so there's a guaranteed payout. And you know what, we'll save the money for you on the side. Now, most of those were terrible products because the investments that they made didn't often take account of the fact that as people get older, their insurance has to be renewed and the cost of the policy goes up. So if people are paying for that, I hate people in their 50s, 60s and 70s paying for whole of life cover when they don't need it. Their premiums are extraordinarily expensive and they just don't need it. So people can definitely save money on that. And the other one, Susan, is house insurance. Now, look, house insurance products are on the rise along with everything else, but people don't, I find, understand fully how the policy is structured. You have three types of insurance in a house insurance policy. One is the buildings, the bricks and mortar, you're covering that. The other is the contents, that's your stuff. And then the third one is the all risk. So that's the special stuff. That's like your diamond jewellery and your fabulous art collection and your racehorses and all that kind of thing. So when people are renewing house insurance, very often insurance companies can suggest that you insure, say, the contents for half the price of the bricks and mortar cover. Now, unless you've got gold-plated taps on your jacuzzi, most people don't need that. They need what they need. And that means physically going around with a notebook and saying, new telly, a new sofa, new bed, new clothes, what would that all cost? Coming to a guesstimate, and remember, just because you're over-insuring doesn't mean you're going to get that. You'll only get what you've lost, and insuring for the right amount.
Well, Sinead, we've certainly got an insight into your house anyway, with the diamond rings and the racehorses and the gold-plated taps and the jacuzzi, like, I have to say. One of the things that I just want to pick up with you, though, is you talked about their whole of life during the 90s, etc. And I want to look at the changing business models of insurance, because in motor insurance in particular, telematics and pay how you drive or pay as you move type of business models are now coming in, where I share my data, let's just say if I was to pay for this, I would be sharing my data with the insurer, and then the insurer, based on where I'm going and how I'm driving, would customise my premium for me. And let's just say if that then was to be transferred into health insurance, like, do you see an environment where one might share their exercise data or their food data or their drink data with or medical data with a health insurer who then says, okay, this is the risks associated with cardiac or diabetes, etc. This is now going to be your premium, Susan Taylor, just for you. So I get a lower premium in exchange for data.
I can't see that happening. And it's for two reasons, Susan. And actually, I wouldn't welcome that. The reason is that when it comes to health insurance, For the most part. I think it's a great idea on the motor side, by the way. I really do. And a lot of insurers now are offering, especially young drivers, mm-hmm. top boxes they put in their car and it checks how they're driving and they get a lower premium if they're compliant. Super idea. On the health side, not so much. And the reason is because under insurance law in Ireland, it's kind of a weird market. It's dysfunctional. There's only really three and a bit providers, four providers at most. And we have a system in place where older people are compensated for by younger people, and it's called community rating. And we've chosen that model because if you underwrite, which is checking people's health and checking their history and checking all of that, like you do with life insurance, if you underwrite health, well, it means that older people who are naturally have comorbidities, more illnesses, they're older, you know, they will pay so much for their health insurance that they'll be priced out of the market. And therefore, the people who need it most won't be able to get it and they'll be left on the public system. So we've chosen a different model in Ireland, which is that everybody pays the same. And even if you're not making any claim, you are subsidising those who are making so much in terms of claim that they couldn't possibly afford the premium if they had to pay for it. So rightly or wrongly, that's what we have. Now, if you start sharing health data, then insurance companies can come back and say, hold on a second, you've had a heart attack. There isn't a chance we're covering you. Or your mother died from a stroke at age 50. You're not for us. Now, once you get down that road with health insurance, then you might as well not have it. So I don't think that's a good idea for the Irish market. I can't see it taking off. The whole legislation would have to change for that. And in markets where you have that, like the United States, then you can see what happens, premiums and benefits as a result. So the kind of federalised private health care market, I think, which is the one we have, it's a bit like Fair Deal. Everybody pays the same and, you know, it's irrelevant how you got there, what age you are or how long you're going to be there. And I think most Irish people would prefer that to stay in place.
A lot of what we've talked about today, Sinead, has related to things like a house, a car, one's health and, of course, the expenses related to that. But the biggest challenge of all is if there's a challenge to your income. And in a report out by Aviva in relation to income protection, it said that 64% of people admitted that they had made no provision as to how they would manage financially if they were unable to work for an extended period. And 52% of those admitted that they just didn't do it because they hadn't gotten around to it. Now, do you think income protection offers value for money? And of course, the self-employed and people in the private sector are probably more likely to be affected by this. But does it offer value for money, Sinead?
I worked in this market, Susan, for very many years. It was called permanent health insurance back then. It's called income protection now. And essentially, it's a form of insurance whereby if you cannot work due to illness or injury, part of your salary is paid. And it's paid until retirement or until you go back to work. The upside of it is that it gives you that comfort level that your mortgage will be paid and that your family life can continue. The downside is that the very people who want it can't get it. And I'd be one of them. And
why is that?
Because insurance companies underwrite this type of policy very strictly. It's a very expensive product because insurers don't know how long they're going to be paying it for. I mean, it's one thing you going out for 6 months with a bad back. It's another thing if you are out for 25 years because of disability. Yeah. So they underwrite it based on your health. It's very strictly underwritten, actually, much more than life insurance. And also on the type of job you do and on how much you earn and how much you would get from other sources. So, for instance, most of us pay PRSI. We'd qualify for sickness or disability benefit if we were off work. So that's lobbed off because, again, under insurance, you can't earn more on insurance than you would earn in work. And, of course, then it feeds into what your employer would pay. So a lot of employers would say, we'll pay you for the first 6 months you're out or we'll pay you with the doctor's note or whatever. So it's a complex product. What insurers want are people who sit behind a desk very safely and do work that is easily quantifiable. What they don't want are builders, labourers, fishermen, self-employed people who maybe do jobs where they could be more likely to suffer an illness or an injury. Landscapers, nurses, they don't want those. And they are the people who are most likely to need income protection if it's in place. So, look, it's worth getting a quote. I think it's a helpful product, perhaps, while you're paying off a mortgage. Because the products that you can normally get to go along life insurance are called serious illness policies, and they pay out a lump sum. They pay off your mortgage. But to qualify for that, you need to be have a very serious illness, usually, you know, a heart attack, cancer, stroke, something like that. Income protection pays out for the bad back or, you know, the broken leg or mental health reasons that you can't work. So it's riskier for an insurance company to take you on, and they're more likely to charge you for it. So I would just urge caution. It would be great if everybody did have it, but that's not always the case.
Well, you mentioned there about having it when you have your mortgage, and obviously the big concern there is the ability to pay for one's home. So whether it is that their income is challenged or else something happens to the house. But I do want to ask you about this. In an era where we have lived through a lot of inflation that has been locked into the system by now, Sinead, as we wrap up our conversation today, the CSO recently said that the median value of a person's main residence, again, this is 2023, so these figures will have moved on since then, was €340,000. And that was an increase of 30.8% based on the 3 years before that. Now, are people updating their house insurance policies accordingly, do you think?
They are not. And it is a very, very important issue. So I'm glad you brought that up. People generally tend to be underinsured on house insurance. In other words, they do two things, really, when they renew their policy. They either underinsure when they're buying it for the first time or indeed on renewal. And they tend to overinsure in terms of the value of the house. So let me just explain that. So if you have a house that's worth €400,000 and it burns to the ground, so that's the catastrophic payout that most people insure for. If it burns to the ground, you don't need to rebuy the land underneath it. You only need to pay for the rebuild cost. And yet lots of people go on insurance policies, they're going on websites to compare prices, and they put in the value of their home, the resale value. That's not what you should be insuring for. It's the actual rebuild cost. And you can get that very easily. The Society of Chartered Surveyors in Ireland have a big table. Most insurance companies have it. And you can find out for your size house, the location, the structure of it, whether it's detached or terraced, and it'll tell you the cost per square metre of rebuilding. So that's the first way. And actually, you can save a lot just by doing that.
And we're right when up against the clock, Sinead. So could you tell us about the second way in a couple of seconds, please?
Sure. So if you're underinsured, let's say your house is worth 400,000, or let's say the rebuild cost is 400, but you've only insured for 300,000. If you have a claim, say a window smashes or a burnt carpet or whatever, you'll only get 3/4 of that value back because you've underinsured on the whole policy. You have to make sure that everything is up to date and everything is insured for the right price.
There's a lot of great advice in that. Thanks so much indeed for joining me. Sinead Ryan, presenter of The Home Show here at News Talk. Really appreciate your time today. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask, what would the proposed savings and investment union mean for you and me? You're welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. And now next up, we're going to be exploring the EU's ambitious plans to better connect savings with investment through the proposed Savings and Investment Union. Now, as Europe looks to fund its green and digital transitions, strengthen financial resilience and deepen capital markets, the SIU could play a really key role. So to help us unpack what this means in practice and the challenges that lie ahead, I'm now joined by Javier Espinoza, Europe's Executive Director with the Capital Forum. Javier, you're very welcome indeed. Thank you for joining Taking Stock.
Thank you so much. Lovely to talk to you.
Now, let's take a bird's eye view at this first of all. There's about €10 trillion in savings across the EU, sitting in deposits, earning very little. And Larry Fink, in a recent piece in the FT, notes that Europeans save more than 3 times as much of their income as Americans, but invest far less of it. So what are the main obstacles preventing Europeans investing in assets that could generate higher returns, Javier?
That it's a very good point, and it's really great the way that you are framing this subject, and you touched on it already, which is one of just cultural differences. In general, EU households in Ireland, particularly in Germany, in Italy, they prefer to keep the money in the bank because as Europeans, we are very conservative. And this is in stark opposition to the way that the consumers, the citizens in the US, for example, think about how to use their savings. They are more keen to put them in stocks, have them in different other financial products are a little bit less risk averse than Europeans. So one main obstacle to get this big ambition of this, EU-wide savings union is one of cultural challenges. And I would say the second big block for this to happen is one of financial literacy gaps. In other words, not only are people very conservative and tend to put just their money in the bank and keep it in savings that earn them very little because interest rates have been at record lows in general, but also people often don't understand what is an investment risk, what is compounding returns, how things work. And as a result, all these trillions that you talked about at the beginning are just in inertia. They're not moving and not doing much. These are two main things. There are more obstacles.
The two areas there that you mentioned, right? One is culture and one is financial literacy. And I do want to talk about financial literacy a little bit later on, but I want to ask you more about culture first. Not from the retail saver's point of view, but from a business point of view, because one of the things that the SIU is aiming to do, it is to connect not retail savers with more business investment. And EU firms raise just a third as much of money from capital markets as the US. And yet, Christine Lagarde says about 300 billion in annual capital flows from the EU to the US. So would this be absolutely transformational for European businesses, even more so than savers?
It would mean a huge sort of change for these businesses. But, just to stay a little bit more in what are the blocks or how do we overcome this, the issue is that, yes, if it happened, but the European Union, Brussels, meaning the member states, the Commission, EU officials, have been talking about having an EU-wide capital markets, of which this is a part of, or a subset, or even maybe a rebranding. We don't know. We're still trying to figure out exactly what it would mean. But the problem is that businesses might be waiting for a long time because there are also issues of fragmented markets. So if you add to these cultural issues and financial literacy gaps, the perennial problem in Brussels is that we talk about the EU, but in reality, we are 27 very different countries with different tax incentives or disincentives, and also very fragmented markets. People here have heard this phrase when we talk about the single market and the single market for businesses, which was your question as to whether or not it would be transformational and it would open up access to this, 300 billion euros flows annually from EU savers. The problem is that we have so much fragmentation, so many different rules, that businesses are here waiting to capture this, and a lot of this money is going to help actually American firms grow, not European ones. So yes, it would be a very transformational. Businesses, I would imagine, should be lobbying hard for this to happen.
So what's the timeline then? In terms of making this a realistic reality for savers and investors and businesses, what is the timeline before people can really see the benefit?
The timeline is a little bit fuzzy, as it usually happens in Brussels. If we just take a little step back, there have been two key reports and one main report, which is by Mario Draghi, who was the former head of the European Investment Bank. In his report last year, he was calling on a savings and investment union, because he said that this would be a radical change to finally complete the capital markets union. In Brussels, for an initiative like this one to go ahead, in February again this year, Draghi was already pushing again for this idea. But in Brussels, for this to happen, we need the consensus of the member states. We need the European Commission to publish or issue a report, then we need the members of the parliament to sit down with the countries and the commission in what is going to be years of talks, you know, to
but
agree.
Do we have enough time to be waiting for all of that, Javier? Like, really, isn't the point? Like, Mario Draghi's report that came out last year was that we're losing ground to the US in terms of productivity. We're losing ground to China when it comes to their AI development. Do we have time to be sitting around for years talking about this?
I think that we are already very late. In fact, this idea of a capital markets union, which, you know, in simple terms, is just the EU coming together and incentivizing investment, moving savings into maybe stocks investments or index funds or other parts of the economy so that we are boosting our industry in Ireland and elsewhere and innovation. We have been talking about this since 2015.
Now, I remember when the Capital Market Union first was touted and I thought, OK, this really sounds interesting, particularly in terms of bringing businesses to the public markets. But this one seems different. There seems to be more urgency behind this. And there's new things here that we didn't hear about in the Capital Markets Union. And one of them I want to pick up on, because you've touched on it twice, is the whole idea of tax and the taxes involved in investing. Now, I'm a big fan of ETFs, Javier. And just to quickly explain to our listeners who are unfamiliar with that term. So an ETF is an exchange traded fund. So it's a fund of stocks or other assets that you can buy and sell in the stock market. Basically a low cost way to get diverse exposure to the stock market. But what I don't like is in Ireland, we have to pay 40% tax on gains. So could you tell us about the tax efficient European savings account that is being put forward in the Savings and Investment Union?
Yes, so this is actually very transformative. So even to take it back and to explain a little bit more, what happens is that Brussels is often accused of, you know, focusing or containing all the power or being very centralized in its way that it does things in general. But in particular here, actually, it is member states that have the power to determine what is the tax rates that they put or tax breaks also that they put. And with this investment, Savings and Investment Union, what they're trying to do is lower the tax. So every time that you buy one of these ETFs that you explained earlier, you have to pay a huge exit tax. But with this new Savings and Investment Union push, it would mean that there would be some so-called pan-European personal pension products, incentives across the EU, where in fact you would have to pay less. And because you cannot be seen as favoring one regime over another, this would mean that it would lower, hopefully, the tax rates that you'd have to pay when you're exiting or investing in ETFs, or it can be green funds, or it can be equity funds, or anything that is long-term investment. Another key interesting thing about the Savings and Investment Union is that you can, if it goes through, you can have this sort of so-called portability, meaning that you can move your pot, your pension pot across different jurisdictions without being penalized. Say you have your pension in Ireland, but you decide that you want to retire in the south of Spain. And I'm just making this up, but let's say that there the taxes are much higher. If we have an even sort of framework, it would mean that you can take it from one place to another without, from one country to another, without being penalized.
Can I just distinguish also, Javier, here, that the difference between the PEP, which is the Pan-European Personal Pension Product, which is a tongue twister and a mouthful all at the same time, that would provide tax advantages for pensions, which, of course, a lot of our listeners are familiar with here in Ireland. But then the tax-efficient European savings account, that would be an entirely new innovation, wouldn't it? Because we don't have that, like, let's say, they do in the UK with the ISA.
Yes, and what is transformational or very interesting, this is as a principle, is that if you have an EU-wide scheme, you would potentially be paying less tax than what you're currently paying, say, in Ireland.
And I think that
it's like ETFs.
And that really would make a difference. My very last question to you is the one that you brought up at the beginning that I wanted to come back to, which is financial literacy. I've worked gratefully with tens of thousands of teenagers in this area.
And it's something that really holds people back. And a study in 2023 from the Irish Funds said that a half of Irish people said their investment knowledge is poor and two-thirds feared losing money by investing. Now, we could be here for a long time talking about how to what to do about that, but what difference would the SIU or the Savings and Investment Union mean for financial literacy?
It would mean that people would be incentivized to learn more about their investments, because if you are starting to hear that the EU, something that maybe is very abstract for people in Ireland really far away, is going to make it that you can invest and pay less taxes, or that you can move your pension around, or that you can have other sort of tax breaks or benefits, I think that this would have a huge effect in people wanting to get involved. But I think it has to also come both ways. It's not just people wanting to be more financially literate. I think that the EU must get better at launching, you know, EU-wide campaigns in Ireland and in other member states where, you know, it's working with schools, with NGOs, with different companies to actually explain to people all this jargon. You were talking about this PEP. It sounds like, you know, a bit of a mouthful. One of the things, and, you know, maybe your younger listeners and teenagers don't remember, obviously, about the great financial crisis, but one of the things that led to huge upheaval and actual real pain for households in Ireland and in the EU is that these people behind the financing and all these tools, they create all this very fancy jargon that can be easily explainable. And I think that the EU and Ireland and other member states need to work together on just simplifying, for example, the comparisons between one investment and another. What does it mean to have basic savings? What does it mean to invest?
Well, I think this is something that we will certainly be looking at closely, because there's more momentum behind this now. There is a big impact that this type of an initiative would make. So I'm sure we'll be talking about this again and again on the show. So, Javier, thank you so much indeed for joining me. This is Javier Espinoza, Europe Executive Editor with the Capital Forum.
Thank you very much.
This is Susan Hayes-Colleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, the economics behind the journey of your food. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Colleton, and I want to share some messages with you from our listeners. So after the piece on intergenerational wealth a couple of weeks ago, James sent me an email with a perspective on inheritance tax for childless citizens in particular. I want to say thank you to Deirdre, who was posting about each element of last week's show, including Dealonomics and NAM's legacy. And when I've been out and about, if there's one thing that gets that warm, fuzzy feeling, it's when you talk about your pets. I've had lots of chats with you about this since I spoke to Charles from Village Vets last week about the economics of pets. That's certainly very, very close to your heart. Now, in recent years, the global food system has come under increasing pressure as it grapples with rising populations, shifting climates and rapid technological advancements. Now, with the value of $10 trillion and the responsibility for a third of global emissions, the stakes here are high for the global food system. So what does this mean for the food in our plates, the waste in our bins and the future of our planet? So David McGee, PwC ESG leader, who has been closely analysing these challenges and opportunities, joins me now. First of all, David, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks very much.
Now, the population is rising. The climate is changing, technology is evolving, but let's look at an issue that's going on in our homes right around the world. A quarter, David, a quarter of our food produced for human consumption goes uneaten. Why?
Yeah, there is the whole issue of food waste and loss is a massive part of the problem, right? Like, we could actually make huge improvements if we could just fix that farm to fork value chain and stop that loss going on. And it's a whole range of issues, right? So we've had upsizing of portion packs and sizes of retail packs. That's been a problem. So that's to give value to the consumer and counter inflation. But actually, very often we overbuy and we want to get rid of. We misplan. We are a nation and a demography that frequently will change their minds and switch what they want to do. And you've got to react to that. And then you end up with food left over. And sometimes we just make mistakes. We overbuy. We buy the wrong things. We change our minds on something. So it is It is a very real problem, but actually it's not just in the home, it's the full value chain all the way through, right? 30% of the overall calories get lost from farm to fork, one way or another. And it's actually, it's a much bigger problem. The problem, as I've described it there in the answer to Susan, is all a kind of a Western developed world kind of answer, right? The problem south of the equator tends to be much more to do with refrigeration, both in the value chain and in the home, and how do you keep food fresh? So it's a problem.
Do you know what I do sometimes, David, is I will open the fridge and I will take a picture and I'll ask ChatGPT what I can do with what's there.
Very interesting. Yeah, there's a technology blending to kind of solve how we feed ourselves. I love it.
There you go. I have an on-call food consultant in the phone at the moment. But you mentioned there about this as a Western developed world issue, right? Let me bring you a Western developed world solution. Ozempic. We had Ben Spencer, who's the science editor of the Sunday Times, on the show a little while ago about the growth of this. It's mentioned in the PwC report all around this area as well. Would that solve an awful lot of the problem? Is basically you suppress appetites, people demand less. Would that actually genuinely help what we're talking about here today?
GLP-1 will certainly, and all of the kind of various brand name drugs that sit underneath it will absolutely kind of change the configuration, right? So we're seeing very significant percentages of the US population already taking some form of GLP-1 drug.
One in eight have tried it, yeah.
Yeah. So what that will do is shift and vary the demand. So already we're seeing a move away from high sugar, high salt foods and away from bigger portion sizes as people adjust their own personal eating habits. The question is, at what point do you have large swathes of the population on it on a regular basis? So we're seeing lots of doctors saying this is a hugely important drug or suite of drugs or taxonomy of drugs that can help with a very real problem. But are we going to see kind of like vast bulks of the population on? So I think it'll change things. We're already seeing food manufacturers and food retailers trying to react to it. The problem, and I know we've jumped straight to the developed Western, one of the problems we have is the misdistribution of the calories that we produce at the moment. So forget the growth problem, right? But we're consuming too many calories north of the equator and not enough calories south. So if you take the 8 billion people on the planet today, 800 million of those people are living in some form of food deficit or food poverty. So another 1.4 billion people are at risk from year to year because of the impacts of climate change on things like flood or drought or geopolitical events. Putting them temporarily or for a season at risk of food poverty. So we've got, when we did our modelling and thought about, we weren't thinking just about the growth of the global population from 8 to 9.5 or 10 billion. We were also thinking, how do we feed everybody equitably? And how do we close that deficit on the roughly 2.4 billion people who are either in food poverty or at risk of it?
Or indeed who aren't born yet, as you say, in line with the rising population. Often, David, when we talk about things like this, there's a sense of it's all over and it's a sense of debilitating despair. And I don't want that to characterise today's conversation. So as I read the global report from PwC about this, a couple of things really stood out to me. One is this, is that meat and milk alone account for 60% of total food system emissions, and all regions reduce the emissions intensity of cow's milk from 2000 to 2020. Specifically, Europe did so by 40%. So can you tell us other tangible progress that has really made a difference that has happened?
I think there's been huge progress made. Like the whole food sector, from input providers to the farmers to the processors, have made huge strides in trying to... They know this is a problem, right? And if I leave global food production as it is today and do nothing with it and fix every other problem we have on sustainability, how we move ourselves, how we build things, how we make things, how we produce power, if I fixed everything else and just let things carry on, food would actually grow and produce as many emissions in 2050 as we are today, right? So we've got to fix that problem. It's a complex problem to solve, but there's been real, huge, very significant attempts to address these issues. And actually at the forefront of that has been some of the companies here in Ireland. Companies like Tierlawn, companies like Carberry have been doing practical investments on the ground to help trials, to help pilots, working with some of the academic institutions we have, and then bringing those pilot learnings out to farms to put it into place on real farms. Emissions are coming down. And you know, before you jump to this question, in all of the modelling we did and a lot of the academic modelling that the UN and other institutions have done, there is absolutely a role for animal-based proteins in the future diet, right? So,
because I do want to ask you about this, yes. Yeah.
So everything we looked at, like there is a real importance in terms of calories from marine life, and good news for Ireland, there is absolutely still a role for dairy and animal-based protein in the future diet. The configuration changes. We've all got to eat more plant-based, but there are technological and farming solutions coming and already showing demonstrable improvements in that emissions profile.
If I can just paraphrase what you're saying there, I think where you're going is that we do need artificial meat-tasting products that aren't meat-based so that we can increase the amount of plant-based food in our diet. And I have to say, I don't see that there yet in the market. Like, if I go to nut butter and I order plant-based chorizo, that's probably the only place that I can go where I would actually taste it and where it tastes in that way. Is the market, and what I mean by the market is the supply of foods like this really out there that people want, David?
No, but like the like markets respond to market demands, right? So I think what will happen here is as people become more aware of it, but also we globally, right, this isn't just an Irish phenomenon, we have an expectation of cheap food. Right. And part of the challenge for food producers is there is a strong expectation that food and food prices are kept as low as possible. And that's a real challenge for food producers, right, who in some cases are not getting the full economic return that they should on livestock or per acre. But what will happen is, as we see that balance, as we see education get right, as we see people want to naturally gravitate, the market will come and fulfill those solutions. Right now, there's not enough, you're right, there's not enough consumer demand to create the kind of the variety and the range. But those products are getting better and better and better. And again, some of our Irish companies are doing amazing work in terms of additives and ingredients and flavourings to help produce better and better quality products that will hit at the right price point and help the consumer address this very real problem.
And this is really something to watch, I think, in future diets as time goes on. But let's stick with meat that is actually meat, because I was really struck by this. You know the way always in conversations around environmental impact, they say reduce your consumption of red meat. But in your report, you actually really pin it down. The emission intensity of beef is up to 32 times that of chicken. So clearly there needs to be a reduction there in the consumption of livestock. So when it comes to where Ireland's future offering from an agricultural point of view comes, what do you say to people who are involved in the farming industry here about what they need to be doing to move in line with what the consumer wants and where government is going?
So go back to my central thesis that I believe there is no kind of scenario where we move to 100% plant-based diet. I just don't see that. I just don't see that as a not in my lifetime. I don't see that as a configuration, right? So, or a scenario. So I think a couple of things happen there. One is that there is lots of technological advances happening here in Ireland, in the US Midwest, in the Netherlands, where people are looking at trying out things with different feedstocks, trying out things with emissions capturing devices, trying out different housing mechanisms. It doesn't suit us here where we like to have cattle out and grass fed. So the first thing is, I think that 32x will change over time as the technological and the breeding advances, and as we profile the DNA of cattle, I think we'll get to lower and lower emissions over time. So that's one thing. The second thing is then the consumer will make choices, right? And the consumer will say, if I want to move and shift here, if you look both on dairy and beef, we have a very strong global brand. And I think if those products move to a situation where people are eating a little bit less of them, but when they want to eat them, they want to get something really high quality, I think that's a real place that we can, and a real space that our producers can play in.
Can I just maybe bring our conversation a bit broader from where we're going to the individual choices that consumers are making and how markets respond to that? Because, of course, one of the lines of service in PwC is advisory and very much focusing on consulting. And the report says, and if I could ask you really to turn this into English for me, please, David, right? The report says that we need to make traditional linear models into integrated circular ones that prioritise climate resilience, resource optimisation and data-enabled transparency. David, what does that mean?
Okay, so let me draw two important things out of that statement, right, of beautiful consulting speak, right? So the first thing is the current value chain for food is completely linear. It starts here and it goes right to the end. And what we've got to do is figure out ways to make sure we are capturing. I talked to a an Irish producer today who wants to move away from, and he's a livestock producer, wants to move away from just looking at what is the value of the cuts of meat I'm getting off the animal to what is the total value of the animal and how do I maximise that? And what's the total value of the land that the animal is standing on and how do I maximise my return on that? And actually look at all of that, look at the waste that's coming off, looking at what's left over both on the packaging and the product and make sure we're cycling that all the way back through. So that's about changing from the linear piece. I think the key to us reconfiguring the global value chain for food, food is a massively fragmented, if you think about food globally, unlike a lot of industry, other industries, there's very little concentration at any choke point where you can say, that's where I can really influence. Massively fragmented. And data is hugely important. If you look at the efforts that companies and farmers are making to move us towards regenerative agriculture, data is hugely important for that in terms of being able to track at field level what's going on in the soil, what's going on in the water, what's going on with the crops, what's the positioning of the tractor, precision tractor move. So actually that data and pulling all that data together, but being prepared, data transparency is important, being prepared to share that with other actors in the value chain so we can cut out the food waste and loss mm-hmm. and actually get a tighter integration between the demand signals out at the retailer and what I'm taking off the farm.
I wish people could see the way you're talking with this because you're a great man to talk with your hands and you're describing A to B here. But David, one thing that annoyed me, right, when I was reading through the
I'm
global
glad
report.
Only one.
As I was reading through the global report, and then I read through the Irish report, of which you were a key architect of, right, is that all the solutions are there. All the solutions are there. They're on paper. And even when I looked at the various different references to the global paper, they're all there. So, David, why do we still have people hungry in the world if the solutions are all there?
So I think, and I must go back and look at the report, but I'm not sure all of the solutions are there. If I look at other challenges like energy, there's some challenges on batteries, but we understand a lot about what we do. There are still areas of food, you touched earlier on livestock emissions, where we don't have an answer that gets me to zero, right? So there's lots of the answer there and lots of things we need to do. The problem comes down, like a lot of the challenge on climate change and sustainability, the resources are misallocated, right? So the individuals, the companies and the nations that have the money to potentially invest in this have competing demands for it, number one. But the areas that really need to spend big money don't have the money to do it. So we need to figure out, and the last two COPs have grappled with that problem significantly. How do you start reallocating some of the resources to try to make this happen faster?
As I say, it might be simple, but it's not easy. And this, absolutely, I mean, I don't mean to oversimplify the complexity of this, but it is the will of the coordinated parties to actually make this happen. And you have laid it all out there in both of those. Really want to thank you for coming in today, David McGee, PwC ESG leader. And let's talk again about this. And I'll be watching out now for both waste and the plates, what's on them in future. Thanks very much, David.
Thank you.
And so that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound, and next week on the show we'll be looking at big tobacco and asking, is their time finally done? So thanks a million for listening and enjoy the rest of your day, and I'm already looking forward to chatting to you next week.